Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihuliwan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning. My guests this morning first met more than 20 years ago when they were among the many Irish people who volunteered to work with Romanian children when the harsh conditions in that country were revealed to the wider world after the fall of the Ceausescu regime. That trip to Romania forged their friendship and has shaped their subsequent lives. Both men continued to work internationally in aid programmes and now, with families of their own, have had to make tough decisions about continuing to work away or deciding to come home. Sean Farrell is originally from Longford and is preparing to move to Zimbabwe, where he will continue to work with Trokra, while Seamus O'Leary is from Wexford but has returned to live in Carlow, where he works for Integrate Ireland. Sean and Seamus, you're both very welcome to the programme.
Morning. Thanks very much, Eugene.
Now, you first met while you were volunteering in Romania, but why had you decided to go there in the first place? Can you remind us of the situation that was there at the time?
I suppose I was living in Wexford at the time, and Kieran and Margaret Byrne, who had a small haulage business, started raising funds and asking people to, I suppose, donate foodstuffs and clothes and other bits and pieces like that in order to bring them over to some of the care centres in Romania. So I suppose I got involved and then over time became interested in maybe going to volunteer myself and see what was happening on the ground and see if I could help out in some way.
What was it at the time that was kind of affecting people so much about it?
I think it was 1989 when Ceausescu fell, and some of the pictures that came out in 1990 were quite stark in relation to the conditions that kids and teenagers with learning disabilities and with physical disabilities were experiencing in the care centres. Many people were moved, but I suppose all it took was somebody like Kieran and Margaret to actually act and galvanise that feeling into action.
And Sean, what was it like then when you got out there?
I suppose for me, it was my first time to really work in a situation like that. I had never imagined some of the conditions I was going to see. I had never seen suffering or pain on the level that I first met in Romania in 1992. The country was in collapse. There was hunger around us. Some of the conditions in the orphanages and in some of the camps where we worked were terrible. And I suppose I was young.
What age were you?
I was 22 at that time, so I was just finished college. I thought to myself, I might do this for 6 months. I suppose I always had an instinct that maybe came from my parents, from mum and dad, that caring for other people was a really important part of my upbringing, and that I wanted to do something to help. And I honestly thought at that time, even that maybe I'll do this for 6 months and then I'll decide what to do with the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But I would have to say that those first 6 months in the summer of 1992 to the winter of 92 completely changed my life. And I knew by Christmas, working on the streets of Bucharest, that I would probably never do anything different. And I met Seamus in July of 92. So I suppose both of us started what would turn into...
Omitting something there, even.
Go on, Seamus.
I met Sean 2 days after he flooded the apartment I was moving into. So
how did he manage to...
It was an accident now, even. Just let me be clear on that.
I don't know. There are different versions of the story. I think absent-mindedness was the reason. You got up in the morning to... Wash or take a bath, put the plug in the bath and turned on the tap.
I was never that bad. I suppose in Bucharest at that time, you know, electricity was there some of the times, water was there some of the times, but you very rarely had both. And there were long periods without either. And I think I had tried to test the tap to see whether there'd be water for Seamus's arrival and forgot to turn it off.
Yeah,
so the bath overflowed when the water did eventually come on. So he was welcome to Bucharest with about 3 feet of water.
Which was nice
apartment.
Given that it was 42 degrees that summer in Bucharest. So,
and Seamus, how did you end up in the same apartment then? Had that been prearranged?
Arranged? I don't think that was in Sean's vocabulary at the time. Sean went out to volunteer but didn't have a place to stay. So a friend of mine had gone out a week beforehand and offered my bed to Sean for a few days while he was... getting settled. So he took my bed and flooded the apartment before I arrived. So
it's amazing we're still talking, isn't it?
But
I think at that time, looking back on it, I've often talked with Seamus about this since, you know, that in some ways it did frame our life stories from that point on. I know I came to within 6 months of being in Romania knowing that I would never do anything else. And I suppose over the last 20 years, it's hard to believe it's over 20 years ago, but you know, the places have changed, the faces have changed. I've worked in a lot of different places since then, different organizations. But I think that feeling that I had that this was going to be something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life, I think that basic drive and instinct never changed. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing, I suppose, we often, when I come back or myself and Seamus meet, we often talk about where our life stories have gone since then. And it's amazing that they have stayed largely, I think, true to that path with all its twists and bends in between, you know, having young families now, both of us have young kids and, you know, things have changed for us. But I think that basic drive and commitment has largely stayed.
I don't think either of us really had worked out what needed to be done or what we could do either. But there was that sense of a desire to do something. But
so Seamus, you were only 19, like when you went out there for the first time. Yeah. When you think back on it now, it being over 20 years ago, what is the image that comes into your head when you think of Romania?
Yeah, it's hard to put words on it. There was a sense of hope there that people had opportunities maybe that the regime previously wouldn't have afforded them. A sense of hope in myself as well, in feeling that, yes, I can contribute something. It might be small, but there's something I can do and I'll figure it out and try and improve it as I go along.
And was there anyone in particular that you met there that stayed with you?
I'm thinking about maybe Romeo and Christy, who are two young guys who grew up in state-run care centres, both with learning disabilities and physical disabilities, both my age. And that sense of, if I changed places, how would the world look from their perspective?
And what were their lives like, Seamus?
At that time, I suppose they were living in a care centre that was run by the Missionaries of Charity. So the conditions were quite good in terms of you know, clothing and care and hygiene and food. But there were limitations as well in terms of what they could do, what choices they could make, what opportunities they were given, because it was still very much at the level of sustenance. I suppose that was one of the questions I brought away then, is that it? Is it just about responding to the immediate situation, responding to the immediate vulnerability that you see before you, or is there something behind this? Is there something that I can do to address the underlying causes, to, I suppose, reduce people's vulnerabilities, to ensure that this can't happen again or won't happen to other people in some way? So,
And what about you, Sean? What was it that stayed with you about Romania?
I think when I came home from Romania, what stayed with me for months afterwards and for years was the faces of people. Some of the children in the orphanage stayed with me, you know, where I dreamt of their faces, of their situations. When we started outreach to a refugee camp, and at the time, many of the people in that camp had been victims of torture in places like Iran, Sri Lanka, and, you know, seeing the scars, both mental and physical, from the torture that they experienced in different parts of the world before they ended up in a terrible situation of poverty in Romania.
How did that happen?
They were trying to get into Europe, and they were caught basically coming across the border from somewhere like Moldova into Romania, trying to get into Austria. And many of these people bore the massive scars of torture, be it from regimes in Iran at the time. Some of them were Iraqis. In the aftermath of the First Gulf War, some were Sri Lankans fleeing the civil war in Sri Lanka. Some were Somalis. And I suppose what always came back to me then after I left Romania was the faces and the stories of those people. I suppose when I first went there, even, you very much are hit by the shock of it all.
Because you're so young.
But then I think you get through that quite quickly, and then the personal stories of the people that you're working with, you know, you begin then very quickly to get to know them as people. Mm. And then the conditions somehow dissipate away. And I found that everywhere I've worked since, you know, like
I think you personalise it. You focus on the interpersonal interactions, and you can't afford to be overwhelmed, because then you're of no use to anybody, including yourself.
And is that why you became friends, do you think?
No, it's because I'm a very forgiving person. Yeah.
I think as well, when you work with people in those sorts of jobs, you spend long nights talking about, you know, what are we doing, how are we making a difference. I often said to people, you know, it is a 24-hour-a-day job, and it's not
lifestyle.
A job.
Yeah,
it's a life choice more than a job.
It's reassuring to come across somebody like Sean who is, I suppose, asking, who you can send the envelope over later, Sean. Yeah. It's reassuring to come across somebody like Sean who's asking the same questions, struggling with the same issues, who seems to come from the same place of motivation. And that, I suppose, it's reassuring that, okay, I don't have all the answers, but at least I seem to be asking relevant questions. And it's good to have somebody who you're able to bounce those questions off and take some inspiration from, even if it's only very small. But, you know, it's that's probably where the friendship grew, because we would have, you know, wouldn't have seen each other for a year or two. You know, our paths went different ways and then came back together again. And it's like picking up the conversation that you had last Tuesday, because you have that kind of drive in common and share some of those formative experiences in common in terms of our early involvements. Mm. Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. Seamus, can I ask, why did you choose the song Aslan this time?
The song this time, I suppose, struck me because of the lyrics, and it struck me quite powerfully after I came back from Romania, and it captures my memory of those times in terms of how stark the experience was, but also in terms of the impact it had on me, and reminding me not to go in with too many assumptions, but try and look at things from other perspectives as well.
Drawing faces in a padded room with nothing but echoes of screams. Am I insane? Am I untamed? Is this the answer or is it a game? Feels like nothing and it looks like you're nothing at all. And we all go down this time.
And that was Aslan there. Sean, you ended up in Romania, but when you left school, you were actually on a completely different path. Why had you decided to become a priest? Because that was pretty unusual for the time.
Well, I suppose I was always very idealistic. My parents, mum and dad, I think, had always taught us the value of caring for other people. And I think I had a very strong intuition in me that I believed I could play some part in changing the world as I saw it. And I suppose coming from near Auchnacliff in North Longford, the way that I saw that I could change that world was through the church.
And why was that? Why did you think that the church was the best route to change the world?
I suppose coming from that place at that time, that seemed to be the avenue that was available to me. And, you know, I went to Maynooth. I did make friends for life from Maynooth. And looking back at it now, it almost seems like a different life, even of a different time. But if the point of it was to find your place in life, then it was completely successful for me. Obviously, I decided at a point that priesthood was not for me, for lots of different reasons.
What were those reasons?
Well, I think, number one, I was very young. I was 17 years of age. And
was that normal that you left school, you finished your Leaving Cert and then you went into the seminary?
It was relatively, I'd say, the people that I went in with, there was a mixture. Some went in direct from school, other people had worked and all the rest, and then come into Maynooth. But I look back on it now and I think that, you know, it was a time of questioning for me around what I wanted to do with my life. And the end result of that questioning was that it led me on a road to Romania. And that ultimately answered the big question for me around what I wanted to do with my life.
And when you decided then that you were going to leave, Sean, was it difficult telling your tutors in the college that you were going to be leaving?
Not at all, I think. By the time you come close to that decision, I think it's evidently clear to everybody.
You told me a story once about telling one of your mentors that you were going to leave this way, and he kind of gave you an exercise in writing poems about that.
I remember the conversation at the time, and it was about recording your reflections in a way that you could almost read them back to yourself. And I suppose I have always journaled and wrote. And I think one of the biggest lessons that he gave me was to have, I suppose, the discipline of write, writing down things as you're going through it. And I suppose I did it in Maynooth. I've done it everywhere that I've lived since. I write extensively. I happen to find poems, the poetry, one of the easiest way of communicating what I'm feeling. I suppose I've always found that to be somehow, I suppose, useful for me as a person in coming to terms with any amount of situations. So I suppose that is something that I very much carried from Maynooth onwards.
And that's a very long way, Seamus, for example, from your farm in County Wexford.
I grew up on a farm in Wexford. There were five of us in the family. We grew up on a fruit farm, so we never had the problem of wondering what to do with our summer holidays. Strawberries were there to be picked before we got the holidays, and there was either weeding or raspberries to be picked or strawberries to be weeded before you went back to school. So I suppose I remember that time as one of a lot of fun, a lot of freedom.
Did you think you were going to follow in your dad's footsteps? Would you have gone into farming?
Well, I did follow in my dad's footsteps in the sense that, yes, I tried the farming, and there's a real sense of connection to the land and to place. And 1798 is an important year in Wexford. And in fact, our family, the O'Leary, is a West Cork name. So my great-great-grandfather came from West Cork with the West Cork militia at the time of the 1798 battle. And he settled down 4 miles away. So the family has been farming there since. So, but I also followed in my footsteps in the sense that as I was growing up, I saw him helping neighbours. I saw him as somebody who was generous with his time. My mother would have been, and still is, quite religious. Dad went to Mass on Sunday, but like when the strawberries had to be picked, then, you know, the strawberries had to be picked. So he was very pragmatic, and he's very, as most people are, private about his own story and his own faith journey. But so I saw somebody in him that had that and was able to, as part of his life, but was able to live out the real meaning of what that is all about. I saw him thinking nothing of abandoning a day's work to go down and cut sticks for an elderly lady, Alice, at the end of the road. So I suppose I followed in those footsteps of being aware of how fortunate I was in terms of the opportunities I had and what I could do with those opportunities, and maybe using some of that to try and find a way to make a contribution.
I suppose
if he's listening to this, I don't know if that'll resonate with him, but there you go. Yeah.
The strawberries will anyway.
Yeah.
Rural Ireland really has that history of community as well. Do you think that that's something that possibly makes you friends? Because Sean, you're from quite a small community in Longford as well. Tell me about your growing up.
So I'm from a very similar background. We didn't obviously have strawberries, but we came from a small farm in North Longford, Mam and Dad. And I have two brothers and a sister. We're a very, very close family, very close-knit community. Still try and get the results of the GAA matches when I'm in Uganda. And I think I still feel that, you know, when I come back to Ireland, I might get home once a year now. At times, working in the southern Philippines, I wasn't home at all for 4 years. But I still feel that when I, you know, go to Longford, that, you know, I'm going back to a place that I came from. When I go to a match that Drumard are playing, as I did last weekend, now that I'm home here for a couple of weeks, and it was great, meeting up with people like Kieran that I played football with since I was, 10 years of age. I think some people see that, when they look at the lives that sort of we live in terms of the development work we do. You know, we've just been 6 years in Uganda.
That's you and your wife.
Yeah, myself and Irene. We went as two, we're coming back as four, but that's a different story. Everyone says Uganda's very productive. Well, it certainly was in our situation. But I think, when they look, a number of years in the southern Philippines, number of years in Romania, number of, 6 years in Uganda, now moving to Zimbabwe. So we're rooting our whole lives up at the moment to move to a country where we've never lived before, whole new set of challenges. It can seem a little bit like boats cast on an ocean, and wherever they land, they land. But I've always felt that, the upbringing we had and the solidity of my background, that gives us a certain rootedness in where you're from and a certain solidity that no matter where you go, that you don't lose sense of being yourself.
Do you feel that same way, Seamus?
Just to pick up on some of what Sean is saying and your earlier question around community, I suppose it's a very fluid word, and we talk about community in Ireland in a particular sense, and I'm thinking about the community that I grew up in, and I feel very much part of that. And part of Ratnur. But when I suppose first went to Romania, some friends asked me the question, well, like there are lots of needs here. Why are you going to Romania? Mm. Why not respond to the needs here? And for me, I suppose the meaning of the word community and home have always been very fluid. So I would ask the question in response, where does it stop and where does it end? So does that mean then I only work in Ratnur, or does it mean maybe in an even more narrow sense, do I only look after my own family? Or maybe I'll broaden it out a little bit and try and make a contribution to my country. But I've never looked on it in that way, I suppose. So I see community as those with whom you engage with at that particular point in time. They're part of the story of your life.
But do you think it's important that you came from a small community when you have that strong sense of belonging to that, and that has enabled you then to go out to the wider world?
It's part of my identity, yes, but I don't know if it's a requirement. I think people with a different background and a different story can bring something else to the table in terms of this work. But in essence, I suppose community is about seeing that you have something in common. So it's about avoiding the mistake of looking at the world as them and us, and realizing that we're all connected in some way. Mm. You know that script song, 6 degrees of separation, that we're all only at most 6 degrees from each other in terms of, you know, that I'm related to somebody who knows somebody else who worked with somebody else who's related to your first cousin.
I think it's 2 degrees. You know, of separation
in Ireland, it's probably less. Yeah. But at a global level, there is that sense of connection, and being able to identify with people at that level, I think, is important.
Sean, you said you came from a very close-knit family, and mm-hmm. you've chosen the next piece of music because it reminds you of your brothers and sisters. It's the Waterboys. Tell me about it.
Well, I suppose two things. So Waterboys, I still think, was probably the best live act I've ever seen. And I can remember, you know, my Leaving Cert year going with mates like Kieran and Sean to concerts that they were throwing in Longford and Cavan and Athlone, and they were just brilliant. And I remember going on holidays in Ireland. My brother Seamus had an old battered Jetta, and myself and Maria, the Nolan and Seamus, would take off with a couple of other friends. And I still remember the Waterboys being one of the cassettes at the time that we played to death. So I've always been a big fan. And then a couple of years ago, Steve Wickham, the fiddle player from the Waterboys, was in Uganda, and he came to visit some of the Trokora projects in Uganda. And we went to one project, and the local lads were playing these little thumb pianos, which they make from little pieces of wire and bits of wood, and they sound fantastic. And of course, Steve picked up the fiddle and joined in on a Ugandan song seamlessly. And we sat there under a mango tree in 40 degrees, Steve Wickham from the Waterboys playing with a bunch of local lads. And it said something about the universality of music and just how it crosses all boundaries. And Steve is still involved. You know, he's supporting Tradford Trokora for us.
Great. Well, let's listen to Fisherman Blues. That was Steve Wickham and the Waterboys playing Fisherman Blues. And that reminds you of his time in Uganda, Sean. And Steve Wickham is also part of Tradford Trokora, which is coming up soon, I think.
It's coming up the weekend of next weekend, the 27th, 28th. And there's 400 events all over the country, traditional music, raising money for Trokora's work.
Seamus, do you play any music yourself?
I don't really. I tried the tin whistle, but it was more for my own entertainment than anybody else's.
And I've heard him singing, so I can definitely say no,
Sean,
to that one.
Yeah.
And your next song choice, Seamus, is based around your own wedding.
That's right. The next song choice is a song from Monsoon Wedding. Ger has been involved in this type of work as well for a number
Ger's
of years.
Your wife.
Yes, yeah. So Ger would have volunteered in Romania and worked overseas as well for 3 years in the Philippines with the Columbans, working in Mindanao in I forget the place she worked in now.
She's going to kill you. She's going to kill you.
She's going to kill me. You remember the name of the place, don't you?
Yeah, but I'm not helping you out on that one.
Honestly, dear, I'll check it out when I go home. But so Ger has been involved in this line of work as well over the years. So I suppose she gets where I come from. We got married in Glendalough in, was it 2006? And one of the songs we had at our wedding was Ajmer Ji Karta, which is from Monsoon Wedding. But it's reflective of, I suppose, the time that I spent in India and Pakistan and my experiences there.
Well, let's have a listen to the song that you played at your own wedding from the film Monsoon Wedding.
I suppose, even we really should have warned listeners that they need to use their shoulders when listening to that music. You know, the traditional Punjabi style of dancing where the shoulders move a lot. But we, as I said, we had that at our wedding.
This is in the church part of the wedding now.
Yeah, in the church, yeah. So we turned to walk down the aisle at the end of the wedding and Michael just pumped up the volume and the roof lifted. So
brilliant.
There's a lot of joy and
film,
energy
even,
in that.
And Seamus was trying to do the Pakistani dance and I can tell you it does not look good.
Yeah. I'd love to have seen that.
But Sean said earlier that music is something that, you know, translates across cultures.
But dance doesn't, Seamus.
But I suppose it doesn't. I suppose music is a language that does transition across cultures, but also music, I think for me, accentuates the fact that cultures do have something rich to offer and it's different. And not everybody likes every style of music and that's okay, but sometimes there are some fantastic musicians out there that, you know, blend music. And I suppose that's what it has always been about for me in terms of this type of work. It's about trying to figure out how does my view of the world blend with somebody else's view and how can we kind of come up with a place that we're both happy to call home.
So even when you say that, like, we can be a global community in some senses, actually we are still quite different in music and dance was one of the things.
And that's
that
okay. It's like there are challenges in that. There are obviously frustrations in that. Mm-hmm. There are also fascinations in that. But it can be quite a fruitful interaction as well. When you're open to that. But the tricky thing, and maybe it comes back to something you said earlier, as I reflect on our work overseas in development and my current work with the Integration Centre in terms of, you know, integration in Ireland and where Ireland is at now, I think it requires a certain openness, which behind it requires a strong sense of your own identity. I think if you're comfortable in your own sense of self, you're more likely then to open yourself to other experiences.
Is it hard to come back when you've been in a country like that for so long? Is it hard to come back and hand over 10 euro for lunch?
It certainly gets easier over time, I would say that. My first time coming back from Romania, it was a real shock. And maybe that was because I was young. This was the first time I had seen anything like that. Mm. I came back and everything struck me. I remember leaving, I also came home overland from Romania. It took me a month to sort of hitch home. Seamus would say I got lost along. He loves my sense
of
direction.
No, I would say that nobody picked you up or people refused to pick you up, Sean, and they were dead right.
Sean, did you do that consciously because you didn't want to jump back home into Ireland, into a different world?
Yeah, I did it consciously, and I think almost the physical movement of coming home from these sort of long-term things sort of helps one on what is also an emotional journey out of one situation back to another. I can remember leaving the borders of Romania and coming through Hungary and coming into Austria and going into a petrol station. I was in a truck at the time and going into a petrol station and just seeing all the chocolate bars. And we were coming from a context in Bucharest where during the winter we were queuing 2 hours in the morning just to try and get bread. You know, there was no food in the stops and donuts we lived on. I can remember a whole winter we lived on donuts, tomatoes and eggs. It's amazing how many things you can make from those three things. Yeah. But when you come from a situation where there's just so little choice.
But there's a story told as well about an explorer who, in the old days of explorations and exploitation, but in the old days of exploration, the explorer wanted to go into the deep jungles of Africa, and he hired his trekkers and he hired the guys that were going to carry all his luggage, and he needed to get there within a certain period of time. So he pushed and he pushed and he pushed, and they made fantastic progress over about 10 days. And then on the 11th day, everybody sat down and stopped and wouldn't move. And he got, you know, he was 2 or 3 days ahead of schedule. all of a sudden alarm bells. So he asked the head bottle washer, if you like, the guy in charge of the team, you know, what's happening? Why have they stopped? What's wrong? As you know, what has happened? And they said, no, we've made great progress, but now we must stop and wait for our heart to catch up. So there was almost like the recognition that there's a physical journey and there's a speed associated with that. But there's also, if you like, a psychological journey. And I suppose one of the things about certainly that struck us and when we came back was the speed at which people were being pushed on a conveyor belt. I suppose I'm just conscious of the fact that the society in which we live in now is encouraging us to live life at such a pace that sometimes we don't wait for our hearts to catch up. We don't wait for our minds to catch up. We're not even sure where we're going. So there's something in that, I suppose, in terms of us travelling home overland and being very fortunate to recognise and make sense of that experience.
Does that make it very different now that you're a little bit... you're more
older.
Grown up.
Yeah, older. Yeah.
Now that you're older
but not more sensible.
Yeah, older and more mature.
And you have children. Is that giving you a very different perspective on the work that you do?
I see, you know, my own kids in kids I meet all the time in very difficult circumstances. And, you know, when I travel into the camps in northern Uganda and I'd see a baby without anything, you know, and a mother sick, and I think of my own lad Luca, you know, and I think of Cara running around and I think, what would it be like for her, you know, not to have clothes, not to have toys, all these things. But also, I suppose I think about it from the point of view of saying, you know, our work is to change this. And I suppose myself and Seamus have always talked about what keeps you in this long term. You know, we're now 20, it's hard to believe 20 years since I flooded that apartment, Seamus.
That's
but
true,
like,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I suppose what keeps us in it long term, I think, is I have to have a positive belief that I can constantly make a difference. And I can remember, you know, getting some advice on that from Mother Teresa at one stage, believe it or not, where we were in the same room in Romania in 1992. And there was myself and two Irish volunteers. And Mother Teresa was sitting there. We were tired after a long day's work in the orphanage. And I remember saying to her at the time, you know, how do you keep going? She was obviously an elderly lady at that point in time. She said that the work that we do is like taking a cup of water and walking over to a vast ocean and throwing the cup of water in that ocean, but always having to have the belief that we are changing the nature of that ocean. And she was saying, all you can do, Sean, in your life is to walk to the edge of that ocean all the time and have the belief that bringing that cup of water is making a difference.
But I think having children makes it very real.
It does, well.
It makes it very real in the sense that the, you know, the love you have for your children, what you want for their future, you're not just contributing to an ideal anymore. You're trying to contribute to something that will make the world a slightly better place for them. And it almost sounds like a cliche, but it's not a cliche when I think of Ronan and Connor and Shay and their future, even at a very local level in terms of my current work around integration and this, you know, the society they're growing up in. It's about trying to create something that will be more a more positive environment for them. And that it almost sounds selfish in one sense in that it's based on the love you have for your children. But it's not. It's that love. It resonates with what you've been. What I've been trying to do. I suppose the second thing that comes to mind is somebody asked me about my work in Pakistan. When I came home from Romania after a few months, it was very easy to describe Romania because I was only there for a few months. So I only knew a little bit, thought I knew everything about it, so I could describe Romania. After coming home from Pakistan, I found it difficult to describe Pakistan because I suppose initially during the first few months, I found out a lot about it. And I suppose the trick is you're transitioning then from kind of scant knowledge, which empowers you to do something that's relevant, to a place where you have deeper knowledge. But that can be disempowering because then you feel like this problem is just too big for me. And you almost have to go beyond that to a point where you realise, well, some small contribution can make a difference.
Is it difficult to be married to men like you who have
not at all
a very large picture of the world.
Probably difficult for Irene to be married to you, or Sean, but that's a whole other conversation.
You can't even remember where Geraldine works, Seamus.
I can't wait to come back to me now.
But what does Irene think, especially Sean, because she's lived with you, she's moved to Uganda with you and to Zimbabwe, and you've had both of your children while you've been working in Uganda.
For Irene, she didn't work in development before we met. As she always would say, you know, she would never have ended up in Africa if I hadn't, you know, grind her down to the point where she eventually had to say yes and come with me. And I remember when we left for Uganda in 2008, beginning of 2008, she said, "I'm going for 1 year. Are you clear on this, Sean? We're going for 1 year."
I remember Irene's going to be listening to this program.
And that was 6 years ago.
Yeah.
But I suppose it is more difficult for our partners in many ways, you know. I suppose I find it fascinating that, you know, we went to Uganda for a year and, you know, for Irene, it was her first time to live outside of Ireland. I had obviously spent almost all my 20s outside of Ireland and, you know, and I now find I've spent a lot of my 30s outside of Ireland as well. But for Irene, it was her first jump and obviously it was the first big jump into the unknown. What has been remarkable is how well it has worked for the two of us, because ultimately, living the sort of lives we do in places like Uganda, Zimbabwe or whatever, it only works if the two people are happy. That is the only way it works. If both are not happy, it falls apart, I would say, fairly quickly. You know, Irene found her own role in Uganda. She volunteered on a number of projects. We travelled together extensively throughout the country. And, you know, and it's amazing now we're, you know, heading off to Zimbabwe. So it just shows how far we've come in the last 6 years. And we're doing so with two kids, where when we went to Uganda, we went as, you know, young and single and the rest, you know.
And has the role changed in the 20 years that you've been working with it? You know, how do you see this moving forward? Seamus, can I ask you, you know, you're working with Integrate Ireland. What does that mean for you that you're doing this work at home now?
Well, at the moment with the Integration Centre, I'm doing work around local integration planning. So working with local councils and local community groups and immigrant-led organisations who are interested in, I suppose, doing something to promote integration long-term in Ireland. But it's in recognition of the fact that Ireland is quite a changed place, even over the last 15 years since we first left, soon after we left, Ireland changed quite quickly to the point that now almost 1 in 7 people who live in Ireland, who call Ireland home, are of an ethnic minority culture of immigrant background. Mm-hmm. And I suppose over the last few years in particular, a lot of people have asked me about this work. Why are you still involved in this work? Haven't they all gone home? And the answer to the question is yes, but home is Carlow. Home is Longford. Home is Dublin. This is home. And while a lot of people have left to their other home, a lot of people have stayed and they have family here, they have jobs here, and Ireland is a changed place. So it's about trying to take the longer term view as well and look at ways in which we can create a more integrated society, a society that everybody can identify with, a society that people can call home, a society that's reflective of different worldviews, different cultural perspectives. And to use a very simple analogy, I suppose, it's like making the choice between driving on the right or the left-hand side of the road. So it
and
isn't
you drive
wrong.
On neither most of the time.
Or in the middle of the road, Sean, yes, yeah. So there's nothing wrong with driving on the right-hand side of the road, but it becomes a problem if everyone else is driving on the left. So, you know, it's a bit like that. We operate within a context. We need to live in the world. We need to operate within the society in which we call home. But there are different ways of operating. And the question is, you know, how can we ensure that everybody's perspective is respected?
And Sean, how about your own role? You're moving to Zimbabwe with your family now. Do you ever see yourself moving home, or what will the future for your own career entail?
Just hope you don't ask this of Irene, because she probably has a completely different answer than I have. But I suppose this has been, you know, a lifelong piece of work, and it will continue. And as I say, the places might change. Obviously, education for the children will become an issue at some stage, and we'll have to make decisions around that. We know now that we're going to Zimbabwe in the next week and we're going to be there for the next 3 years. So that's what we know for sure. We are going to be in Zimbabwe for the next 3 years. And after that, we know we make the decisions as we make them.
Well, to end on that note then, Seamus, we're going to have our final piece of music, which is from U2. And I want to ask, why did you pick The Kite?
I think Sean picked U2 in general. He referred to the fact that I insisted that himself and a group of friends turn up at Crow Park at 7 o'clock in the morning for a 7 p.m. concert.
Complete madness. But, yeah, 12 hours queuing.
If you're going to do something, Sean, yeah, you have to do it right and wholeheartedly.
So can I just give the context of this? Seamus got tickets for the U2 concerts a few years ago in Crow Park, and I got the ticket and I said, great, Seamus, you got the tickets. And he said, we're meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, but it's 7 o'clock in the evening. I thought he'd read the ticket wrong. But he actually thought, no, for their 12 hours in advance of even the warm-up act, we'll be up the front of the stage. So 12 hours queuing outside Crow Park. I think even Mayo fans wouldn't do that for the All-Ireland.
You might be surprised now. Yeah, but Kite, I suppose, is a song about growth and personal growth. I think it's a song that Bono wrote from the perspective of his father looking at him, and from his own perspective looking at his kids and the nurturing that's involved in that. And then, I suppose, a point when you need to let go and you need to allow people to fly, to be their own person. There's a line in it about now I'm a man, and it's the music more than the lyrics. There's an explosion in that part of the song, almost like a new person being born and, I suppose, free in the world, free to make some sort of a difference in the
and
world.
And I hope you got to the front of that.
I hate to say this, but it was actually almost worth it, Seamus, the queue. But
the queue
I know that he didn't say anything about the tea and sandwiches and everything that I supplied from Evie.
Well, yeah, we'll have a listen to the song now. Thank you so much, Seamus and Sean, for being my guests. Sean, it was a pleasure to meet
you
when I was visiting Uganda last year with Stroker. Sheila Naveel was on sound, Ger Philpott was on research, Eileen Hearn produced, and I'll be with you again the same time next week. Here is U2 and The Kite.
Something is about to give. I can feel it coming. I think I know what it is. I'm not afraid to die. I'm not afraid to live. And when I'm flat on my back, I hope to feel like I did.
Evening and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radio player.